Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello and welcome to the Publicly Challenged Podcast. I'm your host, Luke Oswald, and I hope you join me on my quest for knowledge to become a better public land hunter, angler, and forager. Stick with this and who knows, maybe we will learn something together.
All right, I am sitting here and I am with Clay Bowers and we are talking to Judd McCollum. Judd, can you go ahead and introduce yourself for all the folks listening?
I'm Judd McCollum. I'm from Central Illinois. I'm an outdoorsman. I guess that's all I am. I just like to be outdoors pretty much all the time. People wonder if I even have a house. So,
okay, semi-feral. How did the outdoors get started for you? I mean, I know you posted and talked about it and stuff on social media. You love to spend time outdoors. What got you outdoors and what drew you to it?
So until I was about 7 years old, I lived in a house on the edge of town, and down the hill from me, there was a creek that I would try to get to all the time from the time I was a toddler and knew it was there until we moved. And I fell in it a few times and kind of the flowing water kind of got in my blood a little bit. And then when I was seven, my parents moved us out to a house in the country that was on a lake. And from that point on, you know, I ran into one of the neighbor kids that was from a mile away, and they snuck up behind me one day and pushed me down the side of a ravine. And I don't think I ever came out, you know, so.
No, that's pretty cool.
Just,
yeah.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's talk about some things then. I mean, you missed a few things. You are a working class bow hunter moderator for the Facebook page. You still do that, right?
Yes, I sure do.
Is it moderator or admin? I don't know what the difference is.
But either one, admin. It's me and Sean Polk and Dan Smeltz handle it. I think I'm the most visible one because those guys actually have lives and do stuff. But, you know, if I'm out in the woods, I'll stop and check my phone and make sure that dumpster fire is not getting too out of hand and jump in there if I need to.
Right.
But it's a fun gig. It's a great group of guys and the listeners are just great. So
how did you end up getting into that? What ever started that?
I started listening in 2016 and asked a few questions here or there and started going to their bow shoots. And actually, a mutual friend of me and Steve, who used to be on the podcast, got a hold of me and said, "Hey, can you take Steve from the podcast turkey hunting?" And if you don't know the guy, he's
a goofball, right?
Yeah, he's a goofball. That's a nice way to put it. So I was like, yeah, I don't have a tag. I haven't really been on the birds, but I'll take him. And I got him out here. I told him to get here about 8 o'clock one morning and we'd go and see if we couldn't find a bird to begin with. And then once we located it, we'd try to, you know, get in there at daybreak or before the next day. Little did I know that he was afraid of the dark. So he didn't end up showing the next day till about 8 o'clock when the turkeys were just gobbling their heads off, you know, a couple hundred yards from the end of my driveway. But by the time that he got there, they'd flown down and moved off somewhere else. And I don't think we found one until 1:05 PM, which if you're not from Illinois is 5 minutes after the close of shooting for turkeys.
Is that the whole I thought that was only on public land, not private.
No, it's private too.
Okay.
It's the whole state.
Yeah. See, now I always thought that that was a public land, and that was because you had to share the woods with the mushroom hunters and everything else going on in the spring. I wasn't actually aware that that was private land too, but then again, I've never actually had a private land tag, so
Yeah, it would make sense the way you're thinking of it, but it's probably good, but it's that way.
I mean, and is the reason behind that like a fair chase thing? Do you know? Is it?
I think it's so that turkey hunters cohabitate with the mushroom hunters. I think you're right.
Okay, because I see the signs everywhere, and it's like, be friendly, be courteous, share the woods, you know, and it says, you know, no mushroom hunting until 2 p.m., so that gives like a buffer there for the hunters to get out. You see that all the time on public land, but I didn't realize that. I wonder if that was always the case, because I had one tag, and then I never ended up hunting it for spring season with a gun, but I don't know. That was like the first season ever that they actually allowed turkey tags. I drew one.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. I went to the whole meeting, the reintroduction meeting and stuff. My dad drove me. Mm-hmm. I don't remember where it was at, like Springfield or somewhere. He's like, hey, let's get in the car. Let's go. I want to take you somewhere. And he took me to this meeting, and it was like the wildlife biologists. It was the state game agencies. National Wild Turkey Federation was there, and like everybody, it was like the public discussion on the topic of reintroducing them, and it was like a big panel. And then afterwards, it seemed like it was kind of unanimous, you know, and they got the state agency to agree to do it. And then after that, like, you know, you started seeing all the implementation and the release of them. I remember watching, my dad drove me down the road and around the corner a little bit from where they lived, and they had a truck, and they opened it up, and they had like a net on the truck. And as soon as they took that net off, them turkeys just took out in every direction, everywhere. And it was pretty cool. I think they released like, I don't know, I think it was 20 of them. And within about 4 years, that same field, that same area, you could see like 60, 80 birds. It was neat in that one field.
Awesome.
And they spread out from there like crazy. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
I forget how recent that introduction was. I had a guy that I knew when I was going to college who actually sold and maintained those net launcher guns that they used to catch the birds with.
Mm-hmm.
And he had all kinds of stories. But yeah, it escapes me sometimes that that was, you know, that recent. It's really neat.
I mean, it had to have been like, it was in the 90s.
In the 90s?
Yeah, I was like, I want to say I was like 12, maybe 13, because I already had hunter safety. I think my dad took me when I was like 12 or 14. I don't know, somewhere in there. So yeah, it was like 99, maybe 98 when that happened, when they reintroduced them, maybe a little earlier than that, later than that, but it wasn't that far off. And by 2002, I think I was able to draw a tag, or maybe it was 2003, somewhere in there, maybe 2004. The time escapes me, but it was pretty cool. I mean, to be able to see it from conception to actually drawing a tag, even though I never hunted it, you know, it's still pretty cool. Yeah. But
so turkeys were that rare in Illinois beforehand?
Yeah, they were almost non-existent. Yeah, they were extirpated during, you know, the commercial hunting and stuff. Yeah.
But that's odd, because I know for a fact, like when I lived in, when I was a teenager, we lived in Fairview, Michigan, which is like the turkey capital of Michigan. I think that's where they did some reintroduction, but like a long time ago. So there's tons of turkeys there. And I remember as a teenager hitting turkeys with my car.
Unintentionally, of course. Yes. Yeah. Allegedly.
Yeah, yeah. No, unintentionally. You know, like it's just funny to think that you had the opposite. Like, you never saw a turkey. We saw them all the time.
No, you never saw a turkey. You never saw a bobcat. I mean, if somebody was talking about a bobcat, it was like in southern Illinois, real far south, and it was like a rare sighting even then. And now, I mean, bobcats are so prevalent that we can actually hunt them again and get tags all the way up here by me. So, yeah, it's, I mean, It's pretty cool to see what conservation can do, what, you know, what biologists can do when they put their minds together, and state agencies when they actually want to benefit, you know, the wildlife population. It's pretty cool. So I'm just kind of curious, Judd. So that's what happened there. Was that your first like encounter with Stevie then, or what?
Yeah, it actually was. And we didn't, like I said, we didn't really get on the turkeys all that well, but we had a blast and kind of hit it off and became buddies. And then I just kept being a listener and kept contributing here and there. And before you know it, you know, I'm one of the core group. I'm on the team WCB. I, like you said, I manage the Facebook page. I've got a, you know, a key to the studio, and it's good. They're a really good group of guys. I'm in that community because the people are just so great. I mean, when we have the shoots in the summertime, it's up to like 200, 220 people, and there's not a crossword said between anybody the whole day. It's nice. Yeah. It's a really good time.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of agreement there.
When did they first have the first shoots? Like, I remember them coming around in like 2019 or 20 or something like that. But you're saying they had them before?
I think it was 2016, maybe. And okay. It was in a buddy of ours' backyard. Yeah. They're going on 10 years of podcasting, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. They've been around a long time. I do know that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty neat.
Yep.
So I want to ask a question here. It's really important. What is your least favorite wild food?
My least favorite wild food is, off the top of my head, is dandelions. I just can't get past that waxy flavor. But I'm not that well versed on what's edible out there, but what I do know of, I do try.
Well, no, and I mean, it could be meat too.
Oh, well, let me think about that.
When did you start asking this, Clay? Like, this is your new question.
Yeah, I know. I gotta start asking every guest what's the worst wild food.
Okay, the worst thing I've ever put in my mouth, and don't ask me why. I was in Canada in the backcountry, and it was probably a combination of being hungry and bored, but I tried crawfish eggs.
Oh,
okay.
And it was horrible.
So what does that even taste like? Like, just straight up mud, muck, what?
No, it wasn't. I recoiled so hard at it because, you know, you got to get them pressed just right to get them popped in your mouth, because that little egg case is pretty durable. But I just remember recoiling like I was shot. And I just know that it was so bad. I might have blocked it out. I can't describe it. I might give it a whirl this spring if you see one out crawling around.
Yeah.
Wow. That sounds terrible.
It was
what gnarly. Made you want to do this?
Oh, I don't know. I was probably on day 9 of being up in Quetico, and I think it was raining. I think the wind was blowing, so we weren't paddling and fishing that day. And I imagine I got into a place out of the wind and started flipping over rocks, because it's a fun thing to do to kill time. And there was a crawdad there, and oh, look, it's got eggs. Let's see what that tastes like. I got nothing better to do.
Nice. Nice. So do you still do like an annual trip to like the Boundary Waters or something like that, or Canada? Don't you? Like, yep. Pretty much every year?
It's pretty much every year, schedule dependent, because I work on pretty short notice. And if it's looking like I'm going to be within a week or two of the leaving date, then I'll tell my friends ahead of time that, you know, I'm out, because it takes two people in a canoe most of the time. We've got a guy that will take a solo up there, but you usually need even numbers. And if I have to duck out last minute, you know, with passports and stuff like that, it can be kind of a pain to find the right person to fill that spot.
Yeah.
So I try to get up there every year. I think I lost count, but I started going when I was 12, and then went until every year for sure till I was 24. There might have been a couple of years in there I went twice back to back, because it used to be with like a kind of a school related group in a town near me, but I didn't live in that town and didn't go to that school. I just tagged along with them all that time. And then a couple of my buddies and I started going after that intermittently. So, you know, it's got to be close to 20 times I've been up there.
Nice.
Wow.
So let's talk about your college days and your discovery.
Alrighty. I started going to Lincoln College in 2005. It's just a two-year private liberal arts college. And my dad coached basketball there. So since I was about 13, I knew that's probably where I was going to start my college career. And he had always told me there was a professor there that I was really going to hit it off with, because we talked about the same things, we're interested in the same things. And, you know, first things first, I got into his biology class and got to talking to him. And he said, well, I do these muscle studies in Sugar Creek, and there's a couple spots that I'd like to get classes to. He said, but I don't really have the manpower to, you know, clear a trail and, you know, chainsaw logs out of the way and do all that stuff. And I was like, well, I can handle that. That's no problem. So, you know, I brought a chainsaw and a weed eater from home. And the next weekend I cleared the path going out to this sandbar where he wanted to do a study. And I did that to a couple of different places, a couple of different weekends. But this particular one was the week before September 26th of 2005, because that's the day I found the tusk. But so we're standing there on the sandbar looking at the creek, and it was in pretty good drought conditions. There's a lot of gravel showing, and he just mentioned that, you know, there's probably some fossils or something that could be found in this creek. And I'm thinking, you know, maybe horse teeth or marine fossils, because that's about all that I'd ever thought about finding in a creek, really. At that point, I was still ate up with fishing and did that a lot. And so, you know, we walked around that sandbar and kicked some pebbles around. And that was that day. That was a Sunday. And then that week I went into a class and for a biology lab and was informed we were going out to the creek and taking the whole class out there. And so I ran up and grabbed one of three or four pairs of waders that was available of the class, and we hopped on a bus and went out to the site. Had to do some paperwork about water pH, soil conditions, air quality, stuff like that, real boilerplate stuff. And I was done with that, you know, quicker than I could put my pencil down. So I jumped in the creek with the waders on, and there was a couple of guys ahead of me pulling a seine, and they were like, watch out for this rock when you get up to it. And I thought, you know, rock's not going to be any obstacle to me. So I'm walking up the creek, and I've got one of those hard D nets for like benthic sampling, I guess you'd say. It's a shape of a D. It's got a canvas sleeve on it, and the back, a really fine, tough mesh. And so what I was doing was holding that down in the bottom and kicking rocks and trying to catch darters and nymphs or whatever else would come out from underneath these rocks. And so it took me a little while to get up to that spot. But when I did, I stuck my foot out and ran it along the curve and thought that was strange. So the next thing I did was bend down and put my hands on what ended up being a tusk. But when I first put my hands on it, I thought, well, this is probably, you know, a long bone. It's definitely not wood. And it just kind of hit me what it could be. Underwater, I guess I didn't put together that it was a tusk. I thought maybe it was a long bone. But what I did was I rolled it up into the crook of my elbows and heaved it up out of the water. And it was broken into three pieces. And the ends were ivory white and like cobalt blue and then rusty red. And the exterior of the bark ivory was pretty covered in some mud and some clay and some moss and stuff like that. So it wasn't the giveaway that it was a tusk. But I carried that section over to the sandbar and laid it down. And I went back and I got the other two sections, the base section with the root and then the end, and I laid them all out on the sandbar and tried to call my professor over, and he hates it when I tell people this part of it, but I said, hey, I think I found a mammoth tusk, come look at it. And he kind of glanced over and said, oh, it looks like it's probably part of a tractor tire or something, get back to work. And so I said, hey, no, seriously, come here. And so he comes over and looks at it, and for several minutes he was still trying to get my classmates to go back to work. And like shoo people away from it. And he finally was like, okay, this is pretty significant. Everybody can come look at this. He says, I've got to make some phone calls because things have to start happening. So he immediately called the Illinois State Museum and talked to Jeffrey Saunders, who at the time was had his office there. And he was one of the experts on mammoths and mastodons. And he just happened to be right there in Springfield, you know, 45 minutes down the road from Lincoln. And he said, you have to keep it wet if it came out of water or it's going to disintegrate. It's very important that you completely saturate it. Like, don't try to wrap it in saran wrap or anything like that. Like, and he said, it needs to be underwater and it needs to be supported and still. So what we ended up doing was filling those wader legs with water and shoving the sections of tusk down into the legs. And then we buried those in the sandbar and came up with a plan for transport that night, and ended up getting the biggest Rubbermaid containers we could find and filling them with wet blankets in the bottom, and then transported them back to the college where they stayed in those Rubbermaid containers for 10 months to dry out. And after 10 months, we were able to start uncovering them and leaving them uncovered. And it took another 2 months after that for them to be completely like stable and dry. Because what'll happen is those mammoth tusks have a bark ivory on them, and then they've got a core ivory, and those both dry at different rates. Mm. And since they're laid down like rings of a tree, those will actually dry at different rates. So if you say you found a piece of this tusk in the creek and you just thought, okay, this is cool, I'm going to throw it in my truck and take it and drive it around and show people, in that short amount of time, you would lose that tusk. Hmm. So we had a second tusk section that was probably 3.5 feet long that was split longitudinally, and it was gone within 45 minutes of coming out of the water.
Mm. Wow.
It was a pile of bark ivory and sort of a core ivory crumbly slurry kind of deal. But it just what's, they have a word for that. I'm not going to come up with it.
That's okay.
Spalling. Okay. It spalls, yeah, is what they say ivory does when it dries. It spalls. That's it. So it was gone. Basically we kept it on 4 or 5 Rubbermaid container lids for the whole rest of the time I was at Lincoln. But so that was the day of the discovery, and that was a lot. Jeff Saunders did end up coming from the State Museum, and when he came out and he saw it, he just stood there and he said, wow, for a long time. it was probably only a couple of minutes, but it seemed like 10. He just stood there looking at it going, wow, 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 wow. And finally he kind of composed himself and he goes, this is going to resurrect my career. So he told us it's from a mammoth. He couldn't tell us what kind. He said we were going to have to find a molar to distinguish it between a woolly mammoth or a Jefferson's mammoth, which is now thought to be a cross between a Jefferson's mammoth that is the result of a cross between a woolly mammoth and a Columbian mammoth. I think I'm
holy cow. Okay, so it's probably somewhere size wise in between the two then.
In between the two, which, yeah, a Columbian mammoth is the
huge,
biggest.
Yeah.
Huge. And then a woolly mammoth is small. I guess it's probably about the same size as a mastodon, but weirdly proportioned, more so than you would think. He said, you're going to have to find some teeth so that we can measure the thickness of the dentin plates and be able to tell you what you've got here. And so, you know, we thought, well, we just found two tusks. What are the odds we're going to find anything else just rolling around in this creek? So we picked around in there for a few days after class and never came up with anything else. And ended up finishing up that semester and going home. And the day after Christmas, December 26th, my professor, Dennis Campbell, called me and, you know, asked how the family was, and asked how my Christmas was, and said, oh, by the way, I found one of the molars.
Nice.
I was like, well, how'd you do that? And he said, well, I went out there and the water had gone down quite a bit and the chunks of ice had moved a lot of the opposite side of the creek, which was a cut bank, and carved it back a little bit. He said, I threw on a pair of waders, went out there, and I kicked he says, I kicked a big chunk of something and just about walked away from it. But he said, I kind of thought to myself, you know, what would Judd do in this situation? Well, he'd reach down in freezing water and pull out a tooth. And that's exactly what he did. He pulled out what is thought to be one of the largest molars known. It's easily the size of a football.
Wow.
complete with roots. It had a little bit of bone stuck to it. And so it didn't have to go through as rigorous a process of drying as the tusk did. But we had to be careful because those plates will come apart. But to this day, it's still in one piece and none of the jaw matrix around it ever came off. So that confirmed that we had a woolly mammoth, which made that tusk one of the largest woolly mammoth tusks in North America. And so everybody marveled at that and thought that was the big talking point. And, you know, it was great for newspapers and all that stuff. But we sent a little piece of the root section off to Raptor Labs in New Zealand and had it AMS carbon dated. And the result came back 11,600 years before present.
Wow.
And so we thought, oh, great, we contaminated the sample. So Jeff Saunders said, well, let's just saw a hunk off of this tooth and send it in for sampling. And, you know, we'll be careful not to contaminate it or whatever. So we send it off and get the result back. And wouldn't you know it, it's within 50 years of the first sample. And so we have a confirmed date of one of the last woolly mammoths on the North American continent. And here's where it gets fun. Is Eric Grimm was a palynologist at the Illinois State Museum and had been working on a project in Chatsworth with stratigraphy in an undisturbed bog. So he had core samples from this bog that he could reference against and go back to that point in time. And he looked, and since Chatsworth is only a couple hours northeast, he said that's, you know, he'd get a good enough picture of what was going on in this area. And so what we learned was at that time, the glacial front was up past Green Bay, Wisconsin. And the thinking at the time was that mammoths depended on the mammoth steppe right at the foot of the glacier, basically. There's grasses and very little trees, and that's the environment they would have had to have inhabited before, you know, the forest started to move up behind it. But what we learned was this mammoth was probably living in an area of braided streams dominated by spruce and black ash, and would have had probably a pretty woody diet, which shows in some of the wear of the molars, because mammoths are built to eat grass and mastodons are built to forage and browse on woodier stuff. That's why their teeth are structured the way they are. So that was confusing and interesting, because we had this huge, this bull mammoth whose teeth had worn down to at least the gum line, which would have put him at around 55 years old. And he had obviously done fairly well in an environment he wasn't supposed to be. So that was a lot of fun. And we did some dendrology studies. Some guys came out from Arizona and took a lot of samples of trees that were coming out of that same layer as the mammoth. And there was a lot of soil or sediment sampling and stuff like that that went on. And they've built a pretty impressive picture of what was going on in the area of Lincoln 11,600 years ago. So people always ask me, you know, did you get anything for it?
You got the notoriety. You got a notable, an honorable mention, right?
So they named the mammoth after me, which was cool. They taught me how to stabilize that material. So if I ever ran into that situation again, I wouldn't have any problem preserving it on my own without having to call and bother anybody about it. And now if you hear anybody that talks about that period of time, you know, National Geographic, Joe Rogan, who pick your person you listen to about stuff that period of time, people now point to that window of about 11,600, 11,800 years ago being the point where the megafauna really started to drop off and become extinct.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty interesting. So
it moved the goalpost for, we used to think mammoths were gone from North America 22,000 years ago. So it moved that up quite a ways and, you know, kind of changed what people thought.
10,000 years. Like that's,
yeah,
that's a long time to be hanging on when people thought they were already gone. I mean, mm-hmm. So what did we find out about the mammoth as far as what it was like species wise?
It was a woolly mammoth.
It was a woolly mammoth. Okay.
It was a woolly mammoth.
It wasn't like a crossbreed in between then.
Nope.
Okay.
Did it have female pattern balding or anything like that?
No. Never found enough of it to identify that. So that was interesting. Everybody was like, well, where's the rest of it? And what we thought was, since it was probably in a braided stream, that after it died, it bloated and the body separated from what would be an extremely heavy head. Is who knows where now. So that's I don't have much hope of finding the rest of them.
Makes you wonder, I mean, how many more are just out there waiting to still be discovered, you know?
That's the thing about this creek, is it's such a wide, shallow creek, and it excavates down to the layer you want to be at over a, you know, it's probably 30 miles long that it cuts like this. So anywhere else you hear about people finding these things, it's usually at the end of an excavator or a dozer blade.
Yeah.
You got to get through a lot of topsoil to find this stuff.
I know some people not too far from me found, I don't know if they found molars or tusk, but I think it was only one tusk, something like that. And I think they were kids. They were playing when they were kids. And now their barn that they have has a mural of a mammoth on it to like symbolize the find that they found when they were a kid. I don't know if it ever got preserved or whatever happened to it though, you know? So not really sure of that story, but I know there was a little bit of coverage in the paper.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Is that barn still painted like that?
Yeah. 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 It's a pole barn. That. Yeah.
Yeah. Still.
Yeah. Yeah. They painted it years later. Like when they were adults, the two boys, the brothers, they hired somebody to do the mural just to kind of, you know, solidify their find when they were kids. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. But
yesterday I was at the a client's house and he was telling me about a farm field down the road that last year they were doing the spring annual rock cleanup, and they found a big chert blade, like
that's awesome.
Somebody would have used.
That's cool.
They said that they took it in and had it analyzed or whatever and deduced that it was probably like 5,000 years old. By the way that it was shaped or whatever, you know?
Yep.
So, I mean, I don't know. That's just what the guy told me, but that's pretty awesome to think that people were like, you know, 5,000 years ago up in northern Michigan using chert blades to like skin things.
I've got an old, and it's a stone. I don't know if it's like granite. It's got to be like granite or something, but it's polished. My grandpa found it when he was plowing a field back in like 1970. Well, actually, it's my great-grandfather, but 1972, he was plowing his field and he heard something hit the plow and he stopped the tractor and got out and looked, and it was a big stone, I mean shaped like a, almost like a tomahawk, but it's not a tomahawk, it's some type of like fine edged hammer, you know, a hammerhead. And I still got cool. The point somewhere, but I mean it's just kind of neat, and there's one little chip out of the back where I think it must have been where the plow hit it, you know, but it's pretty cool. Just kind of neat to think about that, or how it was used, or the hands that held it, or the hands that made it, you know. But I got to ask you, Judd, so you were actually in a biology class. It wasn't like it was an archaeology class. It was a biology class. You guys were doing creek samples and stuff, stumbled upon this, and then it changed your whole view of everything, and it kind of did a shift you to where you're like, man, archaeology is just awesome now, you know, like, or was it always kind of a passion, you know?
I'd always liked that stuff. Like I'd always liked dinosaurs and all that stuff, but I grew up on reclaimed strip mine ground.
Yeah.
And so basically, unless I was going to find little chunks of petrified wood, there was very little for me to pick up for miles and miles around my house. You know, all my friends that lived along the Spoon River were finding arrowheads like you guys mentioned. And I always wanted to do that, but I could never get off this reclaimed ground far enough to find anything. And so I spent my whole childhood, you know, on
probably
these
found lots of fossils
lakes.
Though, right? I mean, that's the same around here. Like we found all kinds of trilobites and ferns and all kinds of stuff all the time.
Well, I didn't have any of that stuff. They had it was all covered up with about, I don't know, 10 inches of topsoil.
Oh, okay.
So it looked green and it was nice. And there were gob piles probably, you know, 2 miles from my house that I started going to in high school before they were reclaimed. But you know, as far as being in the creeks and being around the lakes and stuff like that, there just wasn't that much. And so I guess it was a whole life of preparing in an area where I wasn't going to find anything. To when I went to this spot on Sugar Creek that was just loaded, you know, I just started finding all kinds of stuff. I found a muskox leg bone and bison, elk, horse, all kinds of stuff. And I've got buddies that live down there now that are just, they're finding crazy stuff still.
Well, you got a friend that found like a giant sloth or something, didn't they?
Yeah, I found a sloth skull. It's probably one of the better ones in existence.
Oh, you found it?
No, one of my friends did. Oh, and okay. So I got a couple of buddies down there, and they messaged me one day while I was at work, and they're like, hey, you're not going to believe this. We found a giant beaver. And so they sent me a picture of it, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, well, I know it's not a giant beaver. And I don't know if you've ever seen a sloth skull like the one we're talking about. It doesn't make sense osteologically that it should be a part of an animal. It's just boxy and strange looking. But I had seen them before. And if you hadn't seen one before, you wouldn't have any frame of reference to know what you were looking at. So they saw teeth, big flat teeth, and they thought beaver. So I said, no, what you've got there is a sloth skull. And you know that because when you look at those two incisors on a beaver, you know, they would be right together. You've seen a beaver skull. Mm-hmm. And they said, yeah, sure. Yeah, it makes sense. They said, but this has a big gap. And I said, yeah, it's got a big gap because that animal had a great big old prehensile lip and tongue that it used to eat stuff. I said, what you found is a sloth skull. And I don't know that I'd ever heard of a sloth skull being found. Mm-hmm. Up to that point, you know, I had seen some scapulas in a museum. They found one in the Tarkio Valley in western Iowa not long after I found the mammoth, and I was kind of familiar with that. And so when they messaged me and said, hey, we got this thing, I was like, that's a sloth skull, and you need to, you know, start work on preserving it. But luckily he found it pretty high up on a sandbar away from the water, so it wasn't like it was saturated. But they did spend you know, a couple of months drying it, and then they used a stabilizer on it, and it's still in his private collection.
I wonder what one of those would actually sell for. I mean, I've heard of like a saber-toothed tiger skull selling for like $1 million, you know. I mean, it makes me wonder.
It's priceless, man.
Yeah, I mean, for the person that finds it, it is, but at some point you gotta wonder.
It's whatever somebody's, it's going to take the right person. It's going to take a person that recognizes how rare that is, you know, being not one of the cool Ice Age animals, I guess, and then having enough money to buy it.
I don't know. I was watching, and I do this time to time, but it was like the, where they take certain animals and they like pair them together, you know, and like fight them or whatever. And it was, I don't know, history, yeah. Discovery, whatever it was. And it was a giant sloth fighting off, I remember it was like the giant bison at the time and some other stuff and like fighting against it. I mean, and the sloth was winning by a long shot. It's pretty cool. I think it fought wolves too. Dire wolves maybe. Yeah. But I was watching one of those the other day. It was on like the streaming, one of the streaming channels. I was like, yeah,
oh, no,
I'm gonna watch it. Yeah.
That's pretty slick. I gotta look for that.
Clay, you've been awful quiet. You got any questions?
I'm just actually just intrigued by all this stuff and wondering what your thoughts are on like the extinctions of those animals and whether it was like human caused or what do you think?
So I was at a museum talk a few weeks ago, and this topic came up of the Blitzkrieg hypothesis, where, you know, we rolled over the Bering Land Bridge, all, you know, 20,000 of us or whatever number of people came over in a pretty extended period of time. and, you know, slaughtered all these megafauna. I don't think that would have been possible. You got to think about the densities of the animals, and you got to think about how dangerous they were. I mean, we're talking about everything bigger than a modern day bison.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, stuff is big. It's not a freaking truck, like a Peterbilt, you know, like a sloth the size of a Peterbilt.
Yeah, I mean, you're not just going to walk up and stick that and be okay. I mean, there had to be some level of cohabitation there, and I think that our part on the landscape as a scavenger was probably much more likely than, you know, we were out there hunting and killing these things. Because we would have had to have been smart enough to recognize that these elephants that we were living with, and they wouldn't have been a new thing to people because they were in, you know, Europe and Asia as well for our entire history. So it's not like we came across into a place where we were just encountering them for the first time. So there had to be some level of you leave us alone, we leave you alone, you know, unless you fall and break your leg sort of deal. You know, it just it doesn't make sense to me, because even, you know, if you look at the Clovis points and you look at those older points that were adapted for getting through heavy fur, I mean, you still got to think about how much hide, how much bone, how much muscle you have to get through to even start to get to anything resembling vitals on one of those animals.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense that you could be that efficient in killing them and need to kill that many over that span of time. You know, the population wouldn't have kept up to demand that kind of slaughter, you know?
Yeah. I personally do believe humans had at least some part to do with it. And I know that there was Meat Eater podcast about a year ago. They had a guy on, and they were talking about these series of kills that had happened somewhere in the Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
And they said it was like a trail of death that there was probably 13 either mammoths or mastodons. I can't remember what.
But I think it was they killed a bunch of calves and one bull.
Yeah, but
is that it?
But they killed like a whole big trail of them in a mm-hmm. row. And it said that it probably took like, you know, 2 days, but they just like killed all of them in this big long line, and then finally took down the adult in the mix. Mm-hmm. But they were talking about how
Gestation periods. I mean, that's 24 months, right, or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that the gestation alone would have made it so that, you know, if there's any excess mortality, that they're going to. So maybe it was like a variety of things, but I do think humans probably played some role.
I'm sure they did. I don't want to sound like I don't think that they didn't kill any, but yeah. Yeah, I agree with you.
I mean, I'd buy a tag today, you know.
Yeah.
So, all right, sure. Let's get into that then real quick. Judd, is the story completely done with the mammoth and the like what's happened? I mean, there's been some recent stuff too, right? Like,
we did find another molar and cheekbone and alveolus, which is the back of the tusk socket that it fits into. And Lincoln College closed a couple of years ago due to strange reasons. And the tusk was removed from the library, which is where it had been since we had got it all put back together, and moved back to the Illinois State Museum Research and Collection Center for storage. But there's talk of it going in the main museum building in Springfield, and hopefully me bringing it up will, you know, keep that on track and keep that maybe happening. I'd be excited to
see
that.
So it's no longer on display anywhere, but you still have access if you wanted to go see it because you were the one who donated it, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, pretty much.
Okay.
The Research and Collection Center in Springfield does have days that are open for tours. They do tours by appointment if you can get a few people together. I don't think they'll do it for just individuals or a pair of people, but it's something you should see because it's everything that's not the state has that is not on display at any of the museums. And usually, you know, the anthropological connections are sensitive right now with all the repatriation going on, so they're not part of the tour. But you can go through the zoology range, which is everything from taxidermy to dry preserved specimens to wet preserved specimens. there's an osteological collection, and then the geology range, which has everything from meteorites to mastodons.
Oh, you're saying any artifacts right now are not being displayed because some of them may have to go back to the native owners or whatever, the rightful owners, huh?
Yep. Their nearest tribal ancestor, I think.
That's a tough one. That's a tough one. I mean,
it's strange, and I've been meaning to sort of get the curator down there at Dixon Mounds by the ear and ask him all about that, because he is an archaeologist on one hand, and he's actually he was the chief of the Oklahoma Peoria tribe, I believe. I hope I'm getting that right. So he's got kind of a foot in both camps.
Yeah.
So I want to talk to him about what he thinks about, you know, what's been learned from those excavations up to this point, and if we would have been better off not knowing any of that and leaving those people undisturbed in the hill. But you know, on the other hand, I totally agree with, you know, they need to be covered up and reburied.
So you're saying I never even heard of the Dixon Mounds. So there's mounds in Dixon. Where are they? Pretty much all burial mounds, or are they other things as well? Kind of like the ones down in Cahokia, where it wasn't just burial mounds, which no longer has tours of the burial mounds, but some of those are agricultural. Yeah. But.
So Dixon Mounds is actually close to Lewiston, and it's named after a chiropractor named Dixon.
Oh, okay.
So they're down here right by where I grew up. And it was they were burial mounds on the Illinois River Bluff.
Okay.
And this chiropractor started digging up an apple orchard so he could plow a field and uncovered remains.
Okay.
And so he dug a little deeper and he uncovered more remains. Before you know it, he had a pit opened up, an excavation with like a Quonset hut sort of deal over top of it. And then I can't remember, in 1946, I believe, the Illinois State Museum acquired it. And then there's now a pretty substantial museum complex sitting on top of this mound, which was a point of contention still.
Yeah.
And it had the open excavations up until 1990, I believe, they were covered. So it was the remains of like 844 individuals all left in situ. With a lot of their funerary objects around them, and what funerary objects were removed were put into displays in the museum. Yeah. And ever since the Repatriation Act updated or started, there's a deadline for the repatriation of all that stuff. So a lot of it's been taken off display. Like I said, the excavation itself has been covered up since 1990. Hmm. But a lot of people around here upset about the museum being so empty, and they feel like it's a part of their history as well, you know, since it's been a part of the community and part of tourism in the area for so long. But
right,
it's really complicated.
Yeah, I mean, I see both sides of the, you know, coin there. I, on one hand, you want people to learn from it, you want people to be able to see it, you want people to understand it and maybe even understand your culture, but on the other hand, you know, is it respectful, is it the right thing to do, you know? Right. That's a tough one for sure.
Well, I hope that someday, thousands of years from now, somebody digs me up and I give them permission right now.
To do what? Are you going to be buried with artifacts?
Yeah, maybe I will.
I just want to be eaten by bears or something.
I need Steve Rinella to figure out that surface dispersal thing that he used to talk about. That's how I want to go. I mean, I don't know how I'm going to go, but I just want my loved ones to cart my pieces out into the wilderness and let the animals.
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying. I want to be consumed by bears or something cool, you know?
Yeah.
Just lay down, die by a tree and let it happen.
I actually think a guy that I shared a birthday or share a birthday with, who's dead now, had one of the coolest stories of his burial ever. And that's Edward Abbey. And he got taken by his friends illegally. And after he died, and they took him out and put him in a sleeping bag and buried him in the desert, and nobody knows where his grave is to this day.
Oh, wow.
No kidding.
Like,
that's pretty
cool. Yeah. His friends are just like, I guess they bought a bunch of beer and just like went out and just like, you know, woo, put him, you know, had a big old party and
Yeah. Had a little Weekend at Bernie situation and right. then put him away when they were done.
That'd be even better. Yeah. Let's just have one more party first. But all right, Judd. So I got to ask you, lately you've been infatuated by native plants and seeds. I've seen you've been posting a lot of stuff. I've commented quite a few times on different things.
You're teaching me a lot.
I hope so. I'll glad to share what I do know, which is very little. But how recently you commented on the Virginia bluebells. You're trying to explain somebody the difference, and I was like, "Have you eaten them yet?" And you're like, "No, no, I haven't." So you ate them. Did you like them?
I did. I could taste that briny taste you described.
Yeah,
it's I grabbed a leaf raw and munched it up, but I intend to go out and get some and throw them on the skillet like I do with the ramp leaves. But I could
make a salad, take that and some like cut cut leaf toothwort, something like that. Give it a nice horseradishy taste. Clysas water leaf is relatively tasteless, so you could throw some of that on there
for filler.
Yep, for some filler, and then of course those earwaxy tasting dandelions.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I'm with you on the dandelions thing, by the way.
What's weird is I still don't like them, but I'm learning to like them the more I eat every year when I do the dandelion challenge. Uh-huh. So when I do that, and if you guys see it on social media, Clay always makes fun of me for it. I don't know. The more I eat them, the more I actually don't really care anymore, and I actually like them. So who knows? Maybe this year I'll eat like 15 or 20 of them.
You know, I just think that's super lame. North America, we have this dandelion challenge, whereas in like England, they have the raw stinging nettle eating competition.
And,
that doesn't sound smart, actually. Yeah. I mean, those trichomes are there for a reason, and they do hurt. So
but what's amazing is like the winner every year eats somewhere in the neighborhood of like 80 linear feet of stinging nettle raw.
No.
Wow. I mean, your mouth would be swollen and numb for days.
You want to know what's craziest about that too is so they have the real stinging nettle in Europe. Like that's
Urtica dioica, like they have
I'm saying that is Urtica dioica.
Oh,
our stinging nettle. Our stinging nettle is Urtica gracilis, and it does not sting as much.
So,
no kidding.
Yeah, so like they used to actually, when I first started foraging, all nettle was considered Urtica dioica, and then they called it an invasive species here, and now we know that it is a native species, and our species is actually different, and it's Urtica gracilis, and it doesn't sting as much.
Okay, this makes sense. We have a friend who's Lithuanian, and she will go out and she will scoop up nettle by the handful, just unperturbed, and make soup out of it.
Yeah.
And I don't even want to brush up against this stuff. And she's out there ripping it out like she's ripping out hunks of turf grass.
I pick it with bare hands.
Yeah. I just...
Now, my wife can't. My wife doesn't do it. She doesn't pick it with bare hands, but I pick it with bare hands. As much lumber, rough cut lumber and stuff as you handle, I think you should be able to pick it just fine.
You know, I don't know that I've ever tried to pick it, to be honest with you. I don't know that I've ever actively gone after it to try and
pick it and I pinch it and pinch the leaves off, and it's fine. I mean, your fingers like sting a little bit as you're doing it, but as soon as you're done, the stinging goes away.
Sometimes though, if you do pick enough, you can get it for like the whole day. Your hands are kind of buzzing.
I have a harder time with jalapenos and cutting those. I started wearing gloves when I make poppers now I had it one time and I couldn't figure out why, and I actually thought, I was like, did I take like some type of pill or something that would cause like an allergic reaction? And then I was like, oh wait a minute, because it was like 2 days later, I'm laying in bed and my hand, like my fingers, I could still feel them like tingling and burning. And I'm like, this is weird. And it was actually because I made like a whole, I don't know, 5 trays of jalapeno poppers. And I cored them all out by hand without gloves on.
Wow.
Yeah.
You ever made that mistake of not washing your hands before you go to the bathroom?
Yeah, I've done that. Actually, that was a Buffalo Wild Wings experience, and it was the Blazin or whatever, like the hot ones were, ate them, and then just wiped my hands on a napkin, went to the bathroom, and I was like, oh, wow, that's intense, that burns. And I mean, it burnt for a while, too.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Judd, you're burning, you said, before we started recording, you told us you were burning your front ditch.
Yep.
What's the burn for?
I'm trying to kill off all the cool season grasses out there so I can, I doubt there's any native seed bank, but I've got a lot of seeds I've collected that aren't quite a big enough quantity to sell to Hoxie. So that's going to be my little prairie patch test plot, I think.
Well, okay. Let's back all that up. All right.
Okay.
So you've recently had this infatuation with native prairie. I believe you even drove somewhere to go and like see native prairie, right?
Yeah.
To kind of like, you're doing your research. Anything you do when it comes to this, like you get hyper obsessed, it seems. And then it consumes your life for a while. But so you went and started researching. You probably watched, follow the same guy, the Native Habitat or whatever the guy is on Instagram or whatever. And started like, I'm sure it just piqued your interest. And now you went with it and started digging into it. But so you started collecting seeds, right? And like, where were you going? Just all over the place, randomly stopping in field edges and hedgerows. And
so my wife's family has quite a bit of ground around here that I get to run around on. And it's not the most up-to-date operation. It's not on the cutting edge of technology. These are all things that have benefited me because there's a lot of places on the farm that for whatever reason are either they've got to be almost virgin timber or they've never seen a plow or spray. So I found a lot of species on our ground. And then it just so happens that the road commissioner has sort of a cursory knowledge of native plants. And so he won't spray the road ditches where there are natives. So he kind of points me in the right direction by, you know, the only live patch might be, you know, 100 feet of prairie dock along the road or, you know, a patch of blue lobelia or something like that just off in the ditch, you know, where everything else is nuked by whatever the heck it is he uses to kill brush. But it's been kind of handed to me. I haven't had to try as hard for it as I'm sure a lot of other people that have gotten into it do, but I'm not sure how it started, but it came on pretty hard and fast. And I just started filling these canvas bags with seed, and now they're all over the house, all labeled, and they're driving my wife nuts, and I'm trying to find homes for all of it.
Nice. So what kind of have you been targeting lately that you're looking for, or something that's really piqued your interest that maybe you haven't found?
So the spring ephemerals that are out right now are kind of have my attention. I was driving down to a barn that I'm working on, and it's sort of in the timber, and I looked over in the ditch and saw a lot of blue phlox. So I had to get my phone out and drop a pin on that to pay attention to. But I'm just getting started in this. There are so many species that I have yet to identify. But the problem is I've got a stack of books sitting here next to me that's got to be 2 feet high of, you know, prairie plants. And there's one here from the Tallgrass Prairie Center of seeds and sprouts of native plants. Like I just go hog wild on it. But the problem is nothing really sticks in my head unless I find it out in the field and, you know, can kind of hang around it and get a feel for it. And then it attaches itself to my brain. I mean, I can look at the books until, you know, my eyes are crossed, but until I'm out there and I actually find the stuff, it's really not in there.
I'm the same way. I will study a book, and what I do now though is I actually keep the books and I flip through them, just randomly flip through them and kind of get adjust or read something and look at it, and then randomly I'll be out and be like, man, I know that, what is that? Why do I know that? and then I'll have to go back and look through. But oh yeah, that's what I found. So it's like it's like a reoccurring. I have to do it in the process to where I see it, recognize it, don't know what the heck it is, and then go back and then research it again. I mean, AI is starting to help with that, but I still just I don't trust it. A lot of people do. I know a lot of people that use apps like the iNaturalist and all kinds of stuff like that, but I'm still not there yet. I don't know.
iNaturalist doesn't ID.
I'm pretty sure it does.
It'll try, but then that's got to be verified by other users, right?
Yeah.
I don't ever take what the app says as, you know, the accurate answer. It's whatever, you know, the consensus
is,
I guess.
Well, but I mean, is like people use iNaturalist. Like I'll use it sometimes to like find, like, for instance, hickory trees, you know, which we don't have. We don't have up by me. So if I'm like down in the fall and I want to pick hickory nuts and I'm somewhere in southern Michigan, I'll look on iNaturalist, like, where's the closest hickory tree to me, you know?
I actually don't use that because I don't want people tracking my stuff. Maybe I'm greedy or maybe I just a little paranoid, but
I got a big geofence on all my stuff.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't want people knowing.
Yeah, I only take other people's data. I'm not sharing.
Oh, so you're one of those people that preaches about, you know, giving back and doing all these things, but at the same time, all you do is take, Clay.
Yeah, I don't have a profile, you know, so like I can't.
Like, yeah, no footprints.
Yeah, I would actually gladly share, and I do, and I say this at all my foraging classes. I tell people, you know, you want to know my information? Sure, I'll tell it to you, because guess what? I've taught probably 1,000 people in the last 14 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And like, how many of them are still foragers? Maybe like 6.
Really? Come on.
Yeah. No, I mean, maybe. I mean, there might be people who are like they're like, I've inspired a couple nutcases.
Like myself, I guess.
But then like the rest of them just fall off, you know, and like you see them years later. And like, I've had friends who said, oh, you're still doing that foraging thing?
Come on. Seriously? Ooh. Wow.
Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, it's like, you know, it's just, I love it. It's like my life, you know?
Right.
Like I get asked about harvesting wild rice every year. Like, oh, you're still doing that rice? You still do that ricing thing? I'm like, yeah, it's like one of my favorite things to do in the whole wide world. Why would
Except
I stop?
I've never gotten taken along either. So I mean, you know, I get it.
I'm sorry. You're not my German psycho, you know, ricing partner who wants to move nonstop for 6 straight hours.
I mean, I can do that. I'll do that.
It's like, you know, when you have somebody that you work so perfectly with that.
I get it. You don't want me to go. I'm never going to go racing with you. I don't want to go with you now. I'm sorry. I like your finger paintings. They're good.
Yeah.
That's a Happy Gilmore reference in case you didn't catch
that. Okay. Yeah. Nice. I got a question for you, Judd. The prairie in Illinois, how different is that going to be from like a prairie that's in South Dakota?
I would imagine. I've never been to South Dakota. I've been to North Dakota. I would imagine rainfall is the difference.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't have an answer for that. You know, I don't have anything really to compare it to, but I can tell you that around here, I've got some oak savanna sort of areas that are natural.
Clay's oak savannas. He loves the oak savannas, right? I mean, isn't that what
I like?
We've talked about, yeah, but that's what we've talked about. And like on the maps, they actually said like oak savanna or whatever type of savanna that was like
open forest.
Open forest, yeah.
Yeah, in Michigan, they were all described as open forest, but they're usually oak hickory savannas. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've got 16 acres of oak savanna that's pretty undisturbed, and I'd take that over, you know, North Dakota any day, I think.
Yeah. Okay, but I guess what I'm getting at here is if you ever found or do you know if prairie turnip is something that you guys had down there or can have down there?
Prairie turnip. Somebody brought this up to me, and they had frustratingly little information. They asked me about it, and then they couldn't tell me about it. And I really couldn't, I didn't find anything about it. So I'm hoping you're going to fill in this gap in my brain, because now it's really starting to itch.
I don't know about the range right there. I know there's like a southern prairie turnip or something that might be able to be found in Texas. And I know that there's a Great Plains prairie turnip. All the Plains tribes used to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
That was the main starch. I was just curious if maybe they had it in Illinois.
Talk more about this. Now I'm super curious, Clay. Yeah. Tell me more about this prairie turnip.
Well, in like the Lakota language, it's called timpsila. It's like the they would have these big braids of it that they would hang in their teepees. They dry it out. It grows on this really, really long like stalk that goes down to a little underground storage organ. And so you'd have to actually dig quite a ways down. And the women used to do that while the men were out hunting the bison. But they would gather these huge, you know, quantities of it and then dry it in these braids. But the cool thing about it is the top becomes like a tumbleweed. So at their harvest period, like this is the traditional ecological knowledge, you know, they knew to harvest it at the point when the seeds would then, you know, blow around the plains and just reseed all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So they were doing like literally no damage. And it's pretty cool, and it's actually really good. I've eaten them. I've gotten to eat them out at in South Dakota, and I used to be part of like a Lakota like sweat lodge group, and
mm-hmm.
sometimes we'd get to eat like prairie turnips.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So
now, this person that brought it up to me was admonishing me for not knowing what it was, and then they couldn't tell me anything about it.
So what's it taste like? I mean, does it taste like a regular turnip? Does it taste like wild parsnip? What does it taste like? Give me more details on what it looks like and what family is it in, Clay?
Luke,
is it Apiaceae? What?
You're gonna hate this answer here, okay? But it tastes like a prairie turnip.
Okay. Fair enough. I don't like it when people say gator. Well, it tastes like chicken. Well, no, it tastes like alligator. I mean, it's got a remnant, you know, taste of chicken. But I get it. I get what you're saying. I know what you mean. Now, when I ask you prairie turnip, what is it? Okay, just like back to the other day when we were talking about water leaf. Okay.
Yeah.
Does it have hints or notes of anything? Kind of like how the Aster family has, to where it's like you could taste like the sunflowery taste, right? Okay.
Yeah. It's not in that family, so it is a pea.
Okay.
So it's a pea family member, which a lot of the plains is like loaded with, like, and I'm sure down in Illinois too, loaded with
locust trees, black locust trees,
nitrogen fixing prairie species. So mm-hmm. I was just curious if you had lead plant, because lead plant is among many nitrogen fixing species, Amorpha canescens, and it is a pea family member. It makes great tea. And lots of prairie species are nitrogen fixing as well.
So does it have like a locust flower taste to it?
No, it doesn't.
Because I mean, that has like that pea kind of taste, right? It would almost, to me, it kind of reminds me like if you ate like a pea flower or something, like, or like a sweet pea, like the same taste is kind of reminiscent of like when you eat like a locust flower too, other than they're sweeter, you know, like,
yeah. Have you ever had a beach pea?
Uh-uh.
I've peed on a beach, but...
Well, it's also, it's just kind of like, not to say, you know, whatever people's beliefs are, but it's just cool that there's all these places in the world that have these nitrogen fixers that are just like in great profusion. And it's like, you could think like, okay, that's some sort of weird design. You know,
mm-hmm.
You know, like all over on the sand dunes in along Lake Michigan, there's these beach peas.
What is a beach pea though? Like,
it's a pea.
So like,
it's literally
like you, actual you look, pod, like,
yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you eat them?
You can eat them. You can't eat too many of them because the pea family is like actually pretty dangerous if you overconsume a lot of stuff in that family.
Aren't they like really severe laxatives?
No, I don't think so. There's so if you eat too many beach peas, you can get this thing called like lathyrism, or I think it's that what how it's pronounced, and it's basically like whole nervous system gets messed up.
Can you get the same thing from like consuming black locust flowers or honey locust?
I don't think so.
So it's just the beach peas that are.
It's also garden peas.
Really.
Yeah, if you eat too many, you can
raw or cooked? Do you think cooking takes out some of the whatever?
Yeah, probably. Okay. But I will state that, you know, it maybe it's like fear and you'd have to consume like a ton. You know, it's like the same thing with sassafras, right? Like the sassafras study, they said that saffron is carcinogenic. But then, like, they were injecting mice with, like, what would have been, like, the 180 gallons of sassafras tea a day for a human or something.
Right.
And then they're like, it caused a tumor.
Yeah, take it out. Kidney failure, right? Wasn't that the other one? It's like kidney failure or something, too, from the sassafras?
I don't know about that one, but I just know that it causes cancer, you know? And so now... root beer can't have saffron in it anymore.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I think I need to harvest some anyway and make some homemade root beer with it.
Yeah. It's delicious. And also, MDA is made from sassafras.
Oh, but don't you have to have a binder for that, Clay? Isn't that a...
I don't know.
Don't you have to have something to bind with the?
I don't know chemistry, chemicals? and I don't recommend people take drugs, Luke.
That's true. I'm just asking curiosity. I'm just simply asking. So if somebody, one of our wonderful listeners, wanted to get more resources or information on it, they could. That's all. Allegedly.
Yeah. But so. What other kind of projects you got going on in that prairie space, Judd?
I'm right now it's education. I want to know what I'm talking about through the whole process before I even start to promote myself. I've been selling for Hoxie Native Seeds for like they would say over a year now. But the bulk of the money that I've made with them has been from hand harvesting different stuff. I've sold probably, I don't know, in the tens of acres at this point, but I'm just not, I don't want to have to, you know, put myself out there and then maybe go and do an on-site consultation with somebody and just have to write a bunch of stuff down and say, I'm going to get back to y'all on it. Yeah. And I know that's part of the gig, but you know, I'm in this to accumulate knowledge more than, you know, to make money, because, you know, if I start making money with it, it's just going to start complicating things with the job that I have now. And it's just going to be a mess. So if I keep the money portion of it as like a benefit, then I think I'm going to, you know, be in it for the long haul. And it's going to be a part of my life going forward. So
I got a question for you then. Clay has recently written some things, some articles about invasives and invasives and the passport to citizenship, I believe is how he phrased it.
Yeah. Right?
So basically how long, and it's, so there's certain things that, you know, we consider or deem invasives, but they've been on the landscape for a long time already. Some things but even plants and we deem these as like the enemy, but at some point we're going to have to realize that, you know, everything's going to work together until it finds its own homeostasis rather than us trying to intervene. What are your thoughts on that? And what's the biggest thing like you thought maybe was a real problem child and turns out it's not?
You know, I used to be one of those people that just thought invasives needed to go at all costs until I actually started doing the work of removing them and understanding the scope of that. and how impossible it is for one person to even tackle 4 acres, let alone, you know, 90.
Yeah.
So, oh, what invasives are obviously autumn olive is a pain. The bush honeysuckles are sort of a pain, but I work with them. Those are probably the ones that I had the biggest problem with that now I benefit from a fair bit because I've learned to open up parts of the canopy in the woods that I deer hunt to create more structure and more obstruction where I want it. I try to remove as much as I create. So I'll do, you know, cut stump treatments and stuff like that on areas where I don't necessarily want it to be, but I do use it, or I don't control it when I could, in spots where, you know, I want to create a funnel or something like that for deer hunting. So
yeah,
I'm sort of guilty of promoting it that way, I guess.
So let me ask you this then, the autumn olive, are your autumn mm-hmm. olive bushes actually producing olives?
They produce little red berries. They don't produce an olive.
Well, no, but do they produce a lot of them is what Luke means.
Right.
Oh yeah.
Are you consuming them?
No. Can I?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're really good.
Are they really?
They're super astringent until they're ripe. And then when they become ripe, like I have a problem, any of the ones that around me do produce, because a lot of them, so they're nitrogen fixing, right? And the more soil, the worse the soil conditions are, the more it seems to be prolific, and they produce these berries so they can produce the seeds and replicate. Well, in optimum soil conditions, I find that like sometimes it doesn't even produce fruit. Like there's autumn olive there and it doesn't produce fruit. It's the weirdest thing. And then other spots, it produces fruit, but as soon as it, like I'll pick them and they'll be super astringent and gross tasting. And then like if you find them and they like the birds decimate them within like a matter of 2 days.
Yeah.
Once they're ripe, they're gone. But yeah, if you find them and you got them, they're freaking delicious. Like fruit leathers and stuff with them are amazing.
No kidding. Like, two sides of this hay field that's out my kitchen window here is just nothing but autumn olive.
Yeah.
And I look at all the berries and just think of what a problem that is, and I'm going to have to start chomping on them.
What do you do, Clay? What do you do for the autumn olive?
Well, I did want to just speak to Judd and how funny it is that so we have nothing but sand up here, and our autumn olives are, all of them, like, for the most part, are just loaded. Like I'm talking branches so heavy sometimes that they're touching the ground because they're so weighed down with berries.
No kidding.
Yeah. And then they'll hang on sometimes until late November and early December. And we've got berries that are available to eat all the way from September to, you know, freaking December.
That's crazy.
Yeah, we do all kinds of stuff. I like to eat I like to eat them just by the handful like crazy while I'm walking by.
Do you eat the seeds that are in them then, or what do you do? Yeah, you swallow them?
Yep. I just chew
lightly.
No, they're very soft.
Yeah.
They're soft seeds. Yeah, you can just chew right through them. And they're actually full of so they're like plant fats, but they are fats.
Like hickory nut, like, you know, same type. What are we, like omegas or something, or what? Like
yeah, not omegas, but I'm just saying like a what is it?
Hackberry?
Polyunsaturated fats, okay. I think.
Okay.
Right? Probably, or maybe some monounsaturated, but so you have sugar in the fruit and then polyunsaturated fat in the seed.
Kind of well-rounded, balanced out seed then. I mean, balanced out fruit.
You know, I actually have a I'm curious. One day I really, like, autumn olive has inspired me so much to I want to travel to like Pakistan and actually like see autumn olive in its native range, because like I get the impression that like it behaves the same here as it does over there. And I've just kind of thought that, because if you watch autumn olive over time, like I have, it just kind of like, you know, like you let some trees move in around it and they shade it out and kill it. The biggest problem with autumn olive is, of course, if you're trying to establish a prairie, then you don't want trees to shade it out.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the biggest one. But we've had success where I've helped people is cutting it down and then just continuously cutting it. Or you could take a little handheld flamethrower and just walk around and just burn off every single time it respawns. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are the times. And then we pounded copper nails into some of the stumps.
I do that in the honeysuckle. It didn't work yet.
It did work for us. We did copper nails and it did work.
I wonder how long though. Like, I mean, does it take like two whole seasons before it does any damage or what?
It seemed to work pretty good. I mean, it basically looked like all the resprouts off the honeysuckles and the autumn olives that we did it to just sort of like were like really weak.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know, because like copper is toxic to all plant tissue, pretty much.
Yeah.
I feel like honeysuckle must compartmentalize itself or something like that because it's so resistant to injury and damage. And, you know, you could broom it out and it would still produce new sprouts. It's just,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's resilient stuff. I was actually in southern Michigan this last weekend and, encountered a section of forest. You know, I was in kind of an open oak forest, and then I walked through to one section, and it's nothing but honeysuckle. It's just like as far as the eye could see. And I was like, oh my God, this is horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. I know a few spots like that.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, I don't want to keep blabbing at you all night, man. Well, you got any questions, Luke?
No, I was just gonna say, Judd, you've got some new goals now. I mean, you're gonna consume some autumn olive and you're gonna be on the search for the elusive prairie parsnip or prairie turnip.
Yep. I do have a question for you guys. Do you have any plans to prepare and eat any of the cicadas this summer?
I don't.
I've had people messaging me and I told them I said, get away from me, Klaus Schwab. No.
Yeah, right.
No. No.
And you will like it. You will own nothing.
I don't have anything coming up by me, but I would love to make a trip down there and eat them because my friend Daniel Vitalis says they taste like peanut butter or something.
Really? Right?
Isn't that what he
now
said?
Now you got me wanting to do it. I don't want to consume bugs, but if that's the case.
I don't know why it's weird. I mean, if it's in salt water, I'll eat it without even wanting to cook it. But, you know, if it comes out of the ground, we're all grossed out. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I've eaten bugs before, right? I was in the jungle of Costa Rica, and I licked my finger and stuck it in some termites and put it in my mouth and ate those. Mm-hmm. But that was because pretty much I was trying to show off. You know,
they're kind of lemony, aren't they?
More sawdusty than anything.
Yeah, that's my experience. Yeah.
Have you guys ever eaten grasshoppers?
No,
crickets. No
parasites in grasshoppers, though, right? Like you get big that's ones. Like the biggest carrier of tapeworms, right?
Yeah, well, you gotta cook them.
Where's the fun in that?
Yeah, I mean, come on, I'm gonna eat a raw cicada now.
Yeah, no, cooking grasshoppers though actually turns them because they have the same like antioxidants as lobsters. Mm-hmm. So when you cook a grasshopper, they turn bright red.
Yeah,
just like a lobster.
Hmm. Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, and, I mean, lobsters essentially are insects of the ocean, right? I mean,
yeah.
And I like bugs. I think they're good. I've eaten plenty of grasshoppers, crickets. I had a cricket party at my house one time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Don't they have cricket tacos in Mexico though? Isn't it like a thing? Isn't it or is that grasshoppers? It's something like that.
Grasshoppers. Yeah.
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 Especially in like Mexico City, that's a big thing.
I think the grasshopper thing is more towards Chiapas and Oaxaca and like southern Mexico.
Okay.
More towards Mayan territory.
Okay.
Strange. But they're called chapulines.
No thanks.
Yeah.
No thanks.
They're yummy.
I mean, I'd rather eat a cow tongue, but whatever.
Yeah. Well, some people think that's gross.
Well, yeah.
A tongue?
Yeah, I don't know. All right,
one
Judd.
Time, yeah.
We could ramble forever, I feel like. But,
oh, yeah.
Judd, it's been awesome talking to you. It's great learning about your project that you got going now. And it's always fun to hear about a little bit of archaeology / biology that stumbled mm-hmm. into archaeology. It's pretty cool to know that you did that, and your name, even if it isn't in the textbooks, anybody who listens to this now will know who it's about. So I think that's pretty cool. Before we go, though, want to ask you, you know, if somebody wants to find you, reach out to you, learn something from you, all that good stuff, or maybe even have you make some hardwood flooring for them or something, where can they find you?
Judd McCullum on Instagram. Same on Facebook, even though I'm not on there hardly at all other than do that moderation work. And the company that I work for is Barnstormers Wood, all one word. So if you need any barnwood, or, you know, we do everything from single boards to almost dried in structures. So
how'd you end up getting into that?
Total accident. It was a total accident. I started dating this girl, and I was just doing like home demolitions to make money and get by at the time. And I think I dated her for about a year, and then her dad was like, how do you like doing that demolition work? Like, yeah, that's okay. And he goes, well, do you want to come and do barn work with me? And so that's how I started doing that. And I've been with him for 13 years now.
Nice. Wow. Nice. That's cool. Well, it's been good talking to you, and I truly appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, guys. This was a blast.
Yeah. Great.
And once again, thank you so much for listening to the Publicly Challenged podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show, and if you did, please subscribe on whatever platform it is you're listening to. Also, if you could leave a review, that would help us out. And you could check us out on Instagram or at publiclychallenged.com. And once again, thank you so much for listening to the show.